This episode is brought to you by FireLapse and FireLapse.com. Too often, drivers fail to extract the full performance potential out of their vehicle at the track because analyzing motorsports data takes time and can be difficult to understand. FireLapse is a fresh and intuitive tool to simplify motorsports data review to allow you to focus on reducing your personal best lap time. This year, Slip Angle and FireLapse have partnered together to help our audience go faster. Annual subscription signups using promo code SLIPANGLE or Slip Angel, will get 15 months for the price of 12 and a free Slip Angle or Track Tune t-shirt. Head over to firelapse.com and start letting your data be your coach. For years, Slip Angle and Apex Pro have worked together to help make drivers faster. The all-new Apex Pro mobile app for iOS and Android is now available on the App Store and Google Play Store. Download the new app for free. Create a user account to log as many laps as you'd like using your phone as the GPS source. Apex Pro is the app for timing your laps and logging your data at the track. With video recording and intuitive analysis features, plus the ability to easily share and compare data, Apex Pro is the best way to learn about your driving trackside. Apex Pro includes leaderboards so you can see where you stack up against other users, and Apex Pro lets you see other drivers on track in real time with the Crew View feature. Upload your data easily to FireLapse to compare with drivers using other data devices. Download for iOS and Android today by searching Apex Pro New. We're back with the second episode or segment of Why Is My Life Hard with Adam Jubay and Rob Fields. Adam, what are we talking about today?
To go to a racetrack, you got to get to a racetrack. And usually you got to get home also. And that sometimes involves making good decisions and driving a simple car and driving it. And sometimes that goes well and sometimes it doesn't. But usually people tow your thing with a thing on a thing. And all those things have a lot of parts. I've had some mechanical problems with trailers and buses and pickup trucks and stuff. What was your trip back from Watkins Glen like?
What did you learn? we learned a few things. It was an eventful one. On the way out to the track, we were going with the toter stacker combo, and the toter on the way, a semi truck tire carcass was in the road, and so that got into one of the front fenders on the toter, and subsequently wrapped the part of that carcass wrapped around one of the axles of the stacker, which led to some damage and some flat tires. So that was a pretty rough one on the way out, but team still made it on time for the event and all that. No major impact to the weekend on the way out there. And then anybody who was at that event knows, it rained practically the whole time, at a pretty, notoriously difficult track, even when it's dry. And we were super thrilled. We had three cars there, zero attrition for our cars, packed everything up, went home. On the way back, toter ran into some shifting issues with the I-shift system on the Volvo semi platform that's built around. And then separately, I was in an F-150 and came around a blind turn and caught a deer. And so we had four problems four problems over the course of the trip with logistics vehicles and transport, but zero problems on track.
Cars were flopped. So lesson one is don't hit the carcasses when the semis shed the carcasses, but sometimes you can't avoid that.
Well, and there was one thing, there is a really solid lesson in that one that was, so we were a little bit spoiled. Our pickup truck and gooseneck combo that we'd been using for a long time had TPMS system on the trailer in the valve stems. Simple, relatively affordable add-on system. I think the issues with the flat tires on the trailer on the way out probably some of the damage could have been avoided if we'd had that system in place and had been monitoring that ahead of time. I think that was a good lesson there. And we, you know, we moved that, we got another one of those systems and put it on. So we've got it on both those, vehicles now.
Those can be like sub $50 systems for the real basic ones too. So,
yeah, they can.
They make ones that just plug, they make ones that plug into the cigarette lighter and they just thread onto the valve stems too. So you can get like really good systems for like just like the price of one tire too. So,
oh, absolutely.
Not crazy expensive and can totally save your trip. If you see a tire going down, you get to pull over and then the tire might be repairable, or you just keep adding air every 50 miles, or, you know, it gives you good information for sure.
Yep. So that was a good one. And then, the other one I'll point out from a lesson perspective there was, we probably could have, planned our trip back a little bit better around, it's tough not to end up driving at night, through strange places sometimes going to and from the racetrack, because we all have jobs and obligations and whatever, and we're all trying to get home at reasonable times and get back to our normal lives. But, that probably the finding that deer with the F-150 was probably something we could have had some risk mitigation in place around, but ultimately
I love risk mitigation. It's my thing.
I will say this though. The body shop that the truck ended up at, had an entire line of swag, prepared for people who had hit deers. I have an official automotive deer hunter sweatshirt that they gave me. nice. So I'm not feeling like I'm the only one in that particular part of New York.
That's a pretty common thing pretty much anywhere deer are, especially because I think we have more deer in the country now than like they had before like the pilgrims came. Like we have a lot of deer right now. So
Bring back the wolves. It's tough. I'm in favor.
yeah. Wolves are really nasty when they come and bite your babies, but they do take a deer down pretty good. the F-150, how bad is it?
It's gone. It's gone.
Yeah.
Wait, the whole truck is not total.
Yep.
Dang.
Total.
Yeah. Wow. No. So I was going, 72 and a 70, and it was so in combination with the turn, I was in the left hand lane, which the left side of the road sloped down and away at a pretty aggressive angle, and so the deer came up that embankment right as I was getting around that curve, and so it was, I never even got to the brake.
So did you hit it with the driver's side corner, or did you square it up, or was it already past you and on the passenger side corner?
No, it was on the driver's side, from the middle of the radiator out around the corner.
Wow.
And it was one of those
smokes the front of it.
Yeah, the motor, it was one of those, the motor shut down, the seatbelt restraint system deployed, the like everything short of airbags. And so that was, and part of it was, when they really dug into that, the airbox and intake had been pushed, it broke the intake, and pushed it back far enough to knock the brake fluid reservoir off of the master cylinder. So it was pretty smoked.
So you killed that deer.
Oh yeah. No, deer's gone.
So then at that moment, was it difficult to stop the truck?
After the hit, like the motor turned off instantly. Actually, very annoyingly, the truck started, into its alarm pattern. So it threw the flashers on for me. It started honking, all that stuff. and I just coasted to the shoulder, and for like a half hour waiting for the tow truck, it was just beep, beep, beep every like 4 seconds. So
that's so weird. I didn't know that was a thing.
It seems to be a standard Ford safety thing. Like if the seatbelt restraint system activates, the thing that like sits you up before you get the airbag, I think if that goes, it automatically starts doing the hazards and the horn.
Yeah, it does the I need an adult dance.
Huh? Well. So.
Sheesh. Okay. Well,
but that anyway,
that was a hard trip for you.
It was, but you know, I think the one thing I'll point out there is that's you know, we're pretty good at dealing with the side of the road stuff and making sure that the cars still make it to the track, that our customers are still taken care of, all that kind of stuff. And that is oftentimes the type of thing that, you know, if you're shoestringing it and doing it all on your own, we're trying to make sure that we keep people's weekends going. And so it's a little bit different, little different dynamic than if somebody has a situation on the road, just kind of in their own personal rig.
Got to have spares and you got to have tools and you got to have know-how when you're trying to give somebody the best weekend ever. So
thanks for listening to another episode or segment of Why Is My Life So Hard?
Getting depressed.
please enjoy the show. It's Saturday night at NJMP. I'm Abe. This is Lip Angle Podcast. I'm here with leaders,
I guess. I don't know how that happened.
I mean, are you P2, Ito?
Overall, yeah.
And Dewey is P1 overall. Well, is that right?
Nick, I am P1 overall. Nick might have no idea.
Nick might have gotten P2.
I think you're still in P2.
Oh. I don't look at overall
much. It's been a strange
day. That is a street GT car in P2.
Yeah, I think so. On the show today is Ito Waxman, or is it Waxman?
That was perfect. No, Waxman's good.
Waxman and Dewey DeWitt, who has been on the show before, spends most of his evenings yelling at me on the internet.
Yes, somebody has to.
No, they don't. I remember. I'm going to start the show off with good vibes only. I remember 6 months ago, we had something to do with the rules or something. You were disagreeable about a decision that Adam and I had made on something, and it's Sunday night at about 11:30 p.m. and Dewey is texting me vehemently telling me that I'm fucking up everything.
Oh geez.
And I was like, all right, I'll deal with you tomorrow.
I don't even remember what I remember texting you. I don't remember what the subject was.
I feel like I never let myself get that worked up about rules. I'm a big believer in I'm just gonna drive faster, I guess,
until you go off track.
Yeah, there's a certain limit.
We both did that
a bunch of times.
You chose the two. Both of us probably had the biggest moments so far this weekend.
I mean, we didn't hit anything.
Yeah, no, they were both managed well, but there's ramps on the outside of the track here, and
the Clibbins had to lay her down, Haas.
Yeah, for sure. So I we did a track inspection yesterday, and we just took the rental out, and we're doing 20 miles an hour, and I just touched the curbs just to see how high they rise up, and it's a lot. If you try to hit that curbing hard, it's going to be gnarly.
The curbing isn't the scary part. It's a car length off the curbing out in the grass. It is Dukes of Hazzard.
Really? Oh, yeah.
So what I noticed, and I think this place is really cool.
We're
at NJMP. Yeah, same. Right after the curbing, as soon as the curbing ends, there is a reasonably sized pothole in the dirt.
Oh, yeah.
Where if you drop a tire there, when you come back, you're probably breaking a wheel.
In a couple of spots.
Yeah.
Where both him and I went off, it's actually extremely smooth. I couldn't believe how much air I caught.
Yeah.
And did no damage. I didn't even hurt my splitter, but all four wheels off the ground. It was, the picture's phenomenal.
So did you notice the drainage ditch?
Yes.
The drainage, and I, thank God I missed that, but like he was saying, it's smooth, but they're smooth jumps, and there's two of them, and I went over both of those. I got really lucky that all I lost were some fender liner pieces, because a buddy of mine when he did an SCCA time trials at VIR, and he did like I did, like he just carried too much speed through South Bend, went off at the outside of the exit of South Bend, totaled an EF Civic. Legitimately, like, he drove it back to the pits, like he was like, oh, something, the alignment feels off, like, we should check that. All the bolts and the eccentrics are in the right place, but then, like, the roof's crinkled, and, like, the wheel gaps on either side of, like, the different wheels looks different side to side. Yeah, they, like, bent the chassis, totaled
the car. Oh, my, that's awful.
And I'm EF Civics are soft.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
And I'm pretty sure, like, if he would have done that there, he probably would have written off another one. I'm lucky that I'm in a somewhat modern, like, a C6 Corvette. And I literally thought to myself, I was like, thank God it was only a fender liner, because, like, I didn't crack an oil pan. I didn't, like...
Corvettes
anyway, don't do what I do.
Are,
don't do what I do.
Very stout. We've had a few of them over the years that have... They've hit some things, and the driver is always safe.
Yep.
Yeah. They're designed like race cars in a lot of
so
ways.
So I am interested now to kind of segue to that point. You know, you work for a very prominent Corvette-related company.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you know about Corvettes.
I mean, my knowledge extends only to C6s somewhat. I'm not familiar with any of the, like, actual engineering that went on behind C6 or C7 development, even C8 development. I'm really just most familiar with, like, race car stuff, with GTE, GT3 cars.
Okay, so let's talk about that. You introduced yourself to me a little bit earlier today and what your background is. Can you, like, for people who haven't heard of you,
mm-hmm.
what do you do? You don't have to, if you don't want to say the name of the company, that's fine.
Yeah.
But, like, talk about your background and how you found yourself
yeah.
in a paddock full of dirtbags like us.
Yeah, so I work as an aerodynamicist for Pratt Miller, which has been designing the Corvette racing cars for the last, like, 20 years. I'm very, very fortunate to be in that position.
No idea you were that cool.
I'm not
so
that cool. I'm not that cool.
I can't even look at you.
Trust me, like, I'm... the people
you
I
might
work
as well say you work for Skunkworks.
Right, seriously.
The people
I work for Lockheed Martin.
The people I work with are way smarter and way more talented than I am. I've come from a, like, I worked at Ford and I worked at Honda as well. Like, I've worked in automotive OEM, and, like, the concentration of the percentage of people who work at Pratt Miller that are brilliant is, like, 90 to 100%. Like, everybody that I've ever interacted with at Pratt Miller is, like, just
how
super
many
smart.
Are they? They're not all in Detroit, are they?
They are. We were recently acquired by Oshkosh, which is a big defense and government contractor. Think like garbage trucks and some, like, military transport vehicles. That's Oshkosh. But, like, all of our headquarters are in near Wixom, like, northwest Detroit area. And within Pratt Miller, started as a racing team, like, purely designing race cars. And then they've kind of expanded into defense and mobility stuff. And, yeah, every department is, like, filled with smart people. This is a huge plug for Pratt Miller, by the way.
I mean, they're
really a huge
cool
sponsor
I mean,
of this podcast.
Cool,
surprise!
It is really cool.
I want to hear about that.
Like, how many people are part of the company? Is that, if that's not, like, oof, private information?
I don't think it's private. It's like 1,000-ish.
Okay.
I don't know. That's probably, like, we have a summit, like a quarterly summit, where theoretically it's an all hands, and it feels like a bay that's about this size.
Okay.
With people, and it's like half of it because the other half is like the race shop. So it's like, it's not that big of a company. It's like, I should say probably like hundreds.
I mean,
so
it's really not a small
1,000 was definitely way too much. Like, it was like hundreds, low hundreds.
Okay. So, as part of your day job, you're, like, around race cars all the time.
Yeah.
Do you, in your actual work, do you travel to events as well, or are you primarily, like, you're at the track for fun, not for work?
Yeah, yeah, that's 100% the case, except this year I was really lucky to go to the Daytona 24-hour because we had a test right after that that I was part of, so I got really lucky that the timing worked out well. But yeah, I'm not part of like the race support team. I'm part of like the development team. So once my group develops the aerodynamics of whatever car we're working on, the next car we're working on or whatever, we kind of just hand it off to the race team.
In your role, are you primarily responsible with designing like components singular, yeah, or does your team design an entire system?
So to give you an idea, this new GT3 car, which I'm allowed to talk about because it's been revealed, there were three aerodynamicists on it. I was the third one. The other two...
He said that totally differently than I expected. There were three. I was the first one.
No. No. The other two have been in the company for about a decade.
He made it sound like he was just tacked onto the end.
No, I'm telling you, like, you're talking to the least smart person, and, like, those guys are brilliant. Anyway... They've been with the company since Pratt Miller designed the Chevrolet IndyCar Aero Kit, which not a lot of people know. The Aero Kit that IndyCar ran between, like, it was 2013 to 2016-ish. That was the Chevrolet Aero Kit was designed by Pratt Miller exclusively.
Yeah, okay. I'm not surprised.
And, yeah, like, so I was the third person that got hired on when this GT3 program got started. And those two have been through IndyCar development, the old ATS GT cars, Pirelli World Challenge cars, C7R, C8R, like the GTE car. So, like, they have way more experience and knowledge, and I'm just, like, still... I was talking to you earlier about the Dunning-Kruger curve. It's, like, my favorite analogy to use. I'm still climbing out of the pit of despair of the Dunning-Kruger curve.
Well,
like,
in certain lines of work, it is common to think of yourself as new for like the first decade of your career. It's certainly the case.
It's almost like imposter syndrome.
Uh-huh, for sure.
Oh, yep. Yeah,
you were just talking about the Dunning-Kruger curve, yeah. So I totally get the pit of despair.
Yeah, and I tend to have the imposter syndrome for everything, a lot of things that I do. And yeah, that's... It's less of that now, where it's like, okay, I think I kind of deserve to be here, but, like, yeah, I don't know. Like, the amount of knowledge they have is just far exceeds my own, and kind of their sense for things and, like, understanding. Like, it's not just, like, the innate kind of intuition for aerodynamics. It's, like, their understanding of the process, their data processing is like next level. That's like my biggest weakness is a quantitative thing. Like I have like a very qualitative mind, and I treat aerodynamics a lot like an art form more than it is like an engineering form.
Sure.
Which is why I love it. The strength I bring to the team is creativity. The weakness is like organization and a little bit of like the quantitative stuff.
Sounds like you're more right brain versus left brain then.
I don't know that. I'm not super familiar with that analogy, but I mean...
Are you left-handed?
No, I'm right-handed.
All right.
Well, it's weird. I write with my right, but I do everything sports-related and everything with
my
left. I don't know.
Yeah. Called that.
I think... I'd have to check my grid life history, but I think you are the first serious competitor to bring a C6 Z06 into Street GT,
mm-hmm,
which might be the car to have.
I think we all kind of called that in the beginning when Street GT was put together. That's probably the answer.
I don't, standing here or sitting here, I don't understand how nobody's run one yet. And
same.
I think the advantage, so I think about everything, like I always want to optimize everything. So ever since I got started autocrossing back in like 2014, I never waste time with a car that I don't think is competitive. The way that I see competition or the way that I approach competing, for me, it's critical that I'm in a car with no excuses, because then I can't use the car as an excuse. All the excuses are the driving. It's a lot easier to benchmark yourself when you have a competitive car. Otherwise, sure. you're just like playing in this space that you don't know where you are, like
my tire
relative to other
were too
people.
Low. They were right. stickers and they were slick.
Right.
It's actually an interesting take on that. I never really thought about it that way, but that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, and I'm cursed with the ever present desire to optimize everything that I ever do, which is a real hassle in a lot of my life. But when it comes to choosing a car for amateur time trials, I'm your man.
Yeah.
Apparently.
So what's the history then of the car? Like, last year you did not run with us.
I did run with you.
When?
In Club TR in a 128i. That was me. Do you remember when I emailed you in 2021 about running a 128i at Mid-Ohio in Club TR? When you didn't have the rule about the 3.0 liter, like the...
Oh.
That was me. Mm. Yeah, so...
He just recently got this car, which
yeah,
is kind
of I bought
cool.
it in October
so then
of last year.
Did you buy it to compete
yes.
in this?
This
yes.
is his first taste of power.
Mm. No. I've owned a lot of cars in my short life, a different level than those cars. Like, it 100% is. And I've spent a lot of time... So I started autocrossing in 2014. I started in an NB Miata. After five events, I bought a dedicated set of tires for that car because I was like, this car's not competitive, but I'm going to keep using the car. Six events later, it's the end of the season, a nationally prepped car comes up for sale, and I buy that because, like, I don't want excuses. I want to learn. I buy that. It's an NC Miata. Run that for a year. Realize the S2000 is a better car for the class. Sell the NC. Buy an S2000. Prep that for the class, which is like very similar to Street GT. Like bolt-ons, coilovers, that kind of stuff. Like do it to that car. Run that for 2 years. Decide that it's too loud when I'm driving it like 12 hours from Detroit to Lincoln.
I get that.
So I buy a fifth-gen Camaro. Where
that, that
I
makes,
and I make sure
sense.
I can stuff all the
That's
wheels.
That's a jump.
Well, so the way it's autocross classing is kind of like pedantic, but I went from like this like Street GT kind of level. There's no equivalent in grid life rules, but like to just stock class.
Yeah.
And I was like, my requirement was I need to be able to carry my race tires in the car with me. Because it's a lot more convenient than carrying a tire trailer, and like I don't like driving on my competition tires because like if I get a puncture, I'm screwed, and blah blah blah. So a fifth gen Camaro can fit a 19x11 rear, 19x10 fronts with 305s on it in the back seat of that car. Because I did
all the tires in the back
yeah,
seat.
Yep.
So the trunk is empty.
Oh, sorry. I did three in the back seat, one in the trunk. Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
It's still impressive.
And then from there, I kept that requirement, but realized for the class, an E92 M3 is faster, so I bought that. I've wasted so much of my money on cars, you guys. It's a problem.
It's not even that bad.
So when I thought I was out of control, I was spending $1,000 to $1,500 per month not doing anything, just kind of like keeping things steady. And I was like, this is too much. This is too much for me. I can't do it that way.
I don't even want to tell you how much I spent.
I know. Well, I mean, you've got the motorhome and all the other things. Like, this is part of our life. I get it. But I was just like, I can't do this.
Yep.
This is the first season where I feel like I'm really actually spending too much money.
I wasn't even talking about events and all that other stuff. That was just
no,
like,
I know.
That was the baseline.
I just bought a new set of tires for it, and it was $1,700. I just ripped off some fender liners, so I got to buy that for like a couple $100. I just spent like $3,000 at K-Tech to like replace my valve springs because I found a couple of them in my oil. You know, like it just keeps going. It's
only
bad.
In LS world, I find a chunk of anything that looks like metal that's a motor for me.
LSs are cool, but also
let me
like
tell you, EJs are not.
LS7s are problematic. And they cost $15,000, and I found kind of metallic-y oil in my oil change before Watkins Glen, and I was like, oil pressure's not any different, I'm just going to send it, and then I've just been running like that. I recently talked to Luke McGrew, and he was like, that's how my oil looks as well. So it's you're fine.
It's fine.
So it's like, I hope it's fine, because, yeah, $15,000 motors are expensive. Anyway, yeah, it's also like I'm newly married, so like, it's not fair to my partner to be like spending all this money on myself. So I don't know. I'm in this right now. I'm in this kind of zone where it's like I'm good enough to compete seriously, and I want to spend the money to do that. But I'm trying to be a responsible adult, which is hard.
It's hard to find that balance.
Yeah, I hate adulting so much. and cars are pain. Cars are just
cars
pain.
Are pain.
Cars are pain. So
you could do what Dewey did and finds a wife that supports him.
No, she's. I feel like
no, 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 no. I'm not saying she doesn't support you.
Yeah,
but that
I mean support you with money.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't think that's fair.
I got really lucky.
Yeah,
my wife is a. She works for Walmart and corporate now, but she was a pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's like corporate level pharmacist. And if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here. End discussion.
Yeah.
So I was trying to say not that she's not supportive of your hobby,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Rather she's not bankrolling your hobby.
Well,
yeah.
So
I mean, she didn't completely bankroll it, but believe me,
dude,
I would not be here.
You are definitely lucky. I don't think it's fair to ask her to
blessed,
do that.
Blessed is a better word for that.
Yeah. Hashtag blessed.
Yes.
But we also, like, as a couple, we like to travel a lot. So some of the money, like, I got to save some money so, like, we can travel and see the world together a little bit.
Get an RV.
Huh? Oh.
It changes this whole situation.
Yeah, I'll make sure Allie listens to this and hears you said that, because I've been, like, trying to tell her, like, hey, like, instead of just buying a truck, I'm just going to buy an RV so that you can come with me and then you don't have to stand in this, like, terrible heat while I'm here.
It is better. It is better by a lot.
And also more expensive.
It is expensive.
Yeah.
And
you know,
if you're not
hold on.
If you're not
handy. It's not more expensive. I'm gonna argue that right now, because I've got my trailer fully loaded down is a little over 10,000 pounds.
Okay.
It just is what it is. My RV pulls that. For me to get a truck that would pull that was reasonably new that I would be okay with that, it was gonna cost 50 to 60 grand.
Yep.
Then I was going to have to go. I would get there. Then I'd have to go get a hotel room or something like that. This, I show up here and I get 9 miles to the gallon with
you
that thing
nine?
Towing. Nine.
When I had mine, we only got like 5.9.
Nine. But I'm also, I bet you were going 80 mile an hour.
Oh, you bet.
But I don't care because I don't have to get there in any sort of real hurry.
That's true.
So I stick the thing at 65 mile an hour and just take a nap. I'm just cruising.
Are you taking vacation days to get here? Or is this like some
I am,
IAG?
Again, we're
like,
going
to
go
hey,
back to Blessed.
This is your job.
We're going to go back to Blessed.
Yeah,
I,
yeah,
I
yeah.
have, what I do here is a lot of, you know, it's promotional for the company.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't lose any yeah. money, but I'm not like I'm not being paid to be here by any means.
That's the hardest part I'm finding is like
that's gonna be rough.
I'm really pushing
PTO
myself.
Do you have
huh?
How many PTO days do you have?
37, but that includes like all of the holidays are taken out of the PTO.
Okay.
I'm not complaining too much about vacation time, other than like I'm left on the political spectrum, so I'm like, give us more vacation time by
yeah,
government law. Like, anyway.
That would be nice.
That we don't have to make this a political podcast, but I'm just saying. I think the vacation time is sufficient. It's hard when I've also got, you know, I want to travel with my wife.
Well, you got family and obligations like, and everything. I get
right,
it, dude.
Right.
That's
when,
not
right.
That's
when
not
your
an
grid
easy
life just becomes life.
Yeah.
Yeah. and like, the new festival format, I love it. But having to show up like Thursday night makes it really difficult.
I agree.
Because you start.
It's a little brutal.
Like a Friday vacation is fine. But like, yeah, like doing a. And I've been. All the festival events I've done have been within a afternoon's drive. I don't know if I can do Lime Rock because like that's 10 hours and it's like really, really difficult to get that done. So I'll probably have to take a Thursday off and a Friday off, and I didn't account for that. And it's
yeah,
like,
but yep. you'll get home by Monday. So it's 2 days off.
Right. It's bad. It's hard. It's hard, I should say. I shouldn't say bad. And like people who, you know, that's what they dedicate their vacation time to, totally fine. Like and I get that. It's hard to balance. And I'm not trying to complain and like.
No.
You know, like, I understand
but
this is my
like,
fault, but...
So, we kind of touched at the beginning of the show, we touched on this, you guys, like, kind of leading in your respective classes for this weekend. I only sort of looked at the overall standings for the year earlier today. Where do you sit in the class points championship? Dewey, start.
So I don't have four events in yet.
Okay.
So it's we're not going to know for another event.
Okay.
Okay, so it's kind of tough to figure out where I'm at, but I've got a second. I've got a win. And if everything works out, I should get a win here and hopefully a class record. So it should
and
get real close.
If I recall, you have a potential tiebreaker in your belt already because you won at Midwest Festival.
Yes.
That means a lot.
It's super helpful, but on the flip side of that, my main competition also has a record point extra.
Ooh, yeah.
So it does change that up a little bit. This is going to be really tight. And that's why anytime we can go to events that are we're against
easy.
Each other, that's a big deal.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Like you physically have to take points away.
Mid-Ohio is straight up going to be a bloodbath.
Is Nick the one you're competing with the most? Or
here right now, but it's actually Mike Omick is it's going to be a bloodbath.
Okay.
And believe me, it's going to be records or rods on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it's
both
be.
Of you are in Subarus too, right?
We are going to crank it. Yeah. And,
Hell yeah.
Both companies work on Subarus, and it's almost turned into a bit of a, you know, gentleman measuring contest. But that's all Time Attack is, and
that's
love
sweet.
It.
Sweet.
So, yeah, like, probably the winner will have more than 100 points.
Yes.
And the second place person will probably have at least 100 points.
Yeah, it's probably going to be, by the time this is said and done, it's going to be like 103 to 102. Like, and it's going to be crazy.
Yeah.
It's going to be crazy. But that's one of the reasons we came here is we were thinking about championship points. And we took a look at this after Midwest and went, this makes sense. We need to shake the car down. It should be kind of a chill event. Mm-hmm. Why don't we try to put an effort into making this?
Sure.
And that's why we're here. And I'm happy we came. And honestly, I liked this event from last year. I just wanted to be here when it was a little cooler.
Yeah. So what about you, Ito? I think you're leading.
No. Not at all.
How are you not?
I've only done two events. This is my third event.
Oh, that makes sense.
But you have won the other two.
Yeah. With lap records.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now I sit sixth. Fifth or sixth?
Those people don't have any idea what's
going on. No idea what's going on.
They kind of do. Like, I think Jackie's leading. I think that his name escapes me now. Oh, Kevin Magnuson.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think he's second in the GT4. I don't remember who's third. I'm sorry. And they've done. Jackie's done four events, I think. Kevin, I think, has done five. Their four event point total is like upper. No, I have to remember this. Their total event points right now is like in the upper 80s.
Okay.
Yeah, they've been trading wins.
Yeah, they've been.
So they,
which is
been
good for me. Which is good for me.
Yeah.
And I've like after today I'll be third, I think. With 78 points. Hopefully.
I think that checks out. Yeah,
that'll
probably happen.
And then Mid-Ohio comes, and hopefully I can secure the win in another track record there. And I'm not trying to, like, show off or anything, but, like, Kevin and Jackie keep, like, I think at this point, if I win Mid-Ohio, I don't think there's, that's not true. They could, I think they could, if they went to, like,
every
Lime Rock, Willow
records.
Run, Willow, like everything and set records, like they could hit 104 points or even 103 points.
Would be a dominant season.
That's
but
what
then,
I'm aiming for.
So if it comes down to 104 points, it's and there are two with 104 points, it'll be the tiebreaker at Midwest, right?
Yep.
And I should have it because I think the first tiebreaker is head-to-head?
Head-to-head, yeah.
Yeah, and I should have that. And then the second one, what's the second one? Midwest Fest is the third one, I think, which I have. I don't remember what the, it doesn't, I don't.
We wrote or drafted the tiebreaker rules while we were at Pit Race last year doing our Enduro. And we were like, okay, we were not super excited with the way the championship shook out in one of the classes where it was like.
Was it Street GT?
I think it was. Where it was like the win came down to who attended more events, and I was like, that's not really like,
mm-hmm.
yeah. it's not really what yeah. we're going for.
Yeah.
And so we tried to make the series of tiebreakers collectively exhaustive.
Yeah. Like,
there's no way for this to end in a tie.
Right.
The final tiebreaker is just
yeah.
who won that event.
No, and I think the new tiebreaker is fair. Yeah, so my goal is to try and hit 104. I think I can do it. I think that'd be sweet. Part of, like, selfishly, part of my motivation is I want to bring partners and you know, people to sponsors to come do this with me.
I don't think that's that selfish. I think that's a very fair pursuit.
So
yeah,
I want to now make a connection between you and Dewey. In your professional life, you do aerodynamic things.
Mm-hmm.
And Dewey's car is known for not making a lot of downforce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like next to none.
Have you ever considered the possibility of moonlighting in your professional experience with cars in the paddock?
Absolutely. You know, like the big group chat I'm in that has a whole bunch of like GLTC guys, Club TR guys, everybody. I constantly get asked for advice there, and a lot of it's pretty basic. It's like, if I seal, like, should I seal the radiator up? And like, yeah, of course. Or like, should I put mesh in front of my radiator? And it's like, well, you know, like you're adding blockage and reducing cooling and stuff like that. But I have thought about like doing kind of consulting work.
There are people who sell their service.
Yeah,
I gotta be
no,
real.
I know.
Like, I would purchase your consulting.
Oh, okay.
So I would. It would be one of those things. Like, I would want 2 hours of your time to pick your brain, kind of thing.
Sure, sure.
That would be sick.
You know, you can do that for free right now.
But
it's totally fine.
If
whenever
it ever comes in, that would.
Yeah.
I think there's actually a market for that.
I really appreciate
do.
That. Where I am right now, talking again about Dunning-Kruger, I'm not comfortable selling myself until I'm like. Maybe like halfway up the climb from the Valley of Despair. And the way I want to, well, first of all, I should say, like, I really enjoy my job at Pratt Miller. I enjoy the people I work with. And I'm learning so much every day. It's just like a never ending faucet of knowledge. And I'm, you know, like, I need to give it, I feel like, a few more years of getting this knowledge where I feel comfortable, like, selling my services in that way. Because,
sure.
like, I don't want to give bad advice. Aerodynamics is a very much not, it's not a black or white, it's always this answer, always not this answer. It's, there's a lot of variables
like
and a lot of variation.
I feel like, in a way, that's, like, the, like, engine tuners are a lot like that, where if you have somebody who's tuning an engine and they look at somebody else's tune, they're mm-hmm. going to find something wrong with it. And you have the same thing with like contractors for houses. No matter what, something's going to be goofy about it, or like they wouldn't have done it this way. Like mm-hmm. I could see aerodynamics being a lot, because some of it's going to be a bit subjective, I think.
It's not so much that as you're trying to... How do I word this? You don't want to make something worse or not functioning correctly because you're applying this like general rule that works most of the time, but like you have to think a little bit more about it, and there's like some nuance to whatever you're working on that changes it.
Sure.
And different aeros will, most of the time, you know, like I think with aero, a lot of it is like, I think an aerodynamicist who's like, I think, not like stuck up or not egotistical, and I don't know anybody, but I'm just saying, they'll see something and they'll really think about it. Like, okay, did I consider this? Maybe that's what they considered when they made this. And the other thing is, like, honestly, one of the big things I learned at Pratt Miller is like, just giving advice based on something, how something looks, is like really dangerous.
Sure.
And if you talk to my coworkers and you ask for their advice, their first thing they're going to say is, you need to test it.
Yeah.
And that's
the
truth.
What's the data say?
Yeah. Right. And that's the truth. And wind tunnels cost a lot of money. Like, a lot of money. So part of it is like, I think if I want to, and actually I saw your video at Aerodyne.
Yeah.
Which is, Aerodyne is like, it's a wind tunnel in North Carolina. A lot of NASCAR teams use it. Bike teams use it. They have like two tunnels. One of them is like a bike tunnel. One of them is like a car tunnel.
So it's out there. I'm pretty sure I was in the bike tunnel.
Right. And actually, and I'll be honest with you, like, I see those videos.
Yes.
And I'm not,
it
doesn't feel like you don't have a moving ground.
Exactly.
You don't have like rotating wheels.
So there's data missing from the situation.
Yeah.
A lot
and
of
you
data.
Have a blockage rate. Like you're, the yep. car is huge inside this tunnel.
I agree.
And trust me, that has a huge effect on the downforce numbers you're getting,
yep.
the drag numbers you're getting. I think, again, this is kind of conjecture, so I'm trying to be careful here, but like, I think the deltas probably still apply, but like total numbers, I don't necessarily trust
well,
that kind
I,
of stuff.
I agree with that. I looked a little more into that later on, and again, I am not an aerodynamicist mm-hmm. by any mm-hmm. means, but I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Exactly. There were so many variables that piece of equipment couldn't exactly account for.
Yeah.
And now that you're actually saying about the, like, basically the internal volume of that, mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Right. Like, again, I'm not a professional, but I assume that to do some of that work, you probably have to make some amount of assumptions, like... Can you assume that the presence of the vehicle is not obstructed by the wall that is some
right.
way?
Like, the name of the game in aero testing is minimizing those questions.
Yeah.
That's right. The name of the game. All of aero testing is it's like basic high school chemistry of like independent and dependent variables.
Oh, sure.
All of it. Like that's literally like when you really think about it, okay, like this is the way I like to describe it. A wind tunnel is a really, really dumb tool. You are blowing wind at something that is attached to a scale. And all you're reading is what the scale is saying.
That's
not a lot of information.
That's a fact. Yeah.
Like, and you really think about it, it kind of blows your mind. You're like, how are people making so much money and how is this so complex? How are we doing, like, so, it's stupid. It's, like, really stupid and actually, like, and this is also, like, I don't want to scare people that are afraid of planes because planes are way simpler than cars, let me tell you. Like, especially subsonic, like, I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss
podcast.
Okay.
Fuck the show.
like, low-speed planes or, like, passenger planes that are, like, transonic, it gets more complicated.
Okay,
anyway.
This is a really interesting topic. Can I ask, what is the difference between cars and planes that makes cars so much more complicated?
So, cars,
well,
you've got...
wheels that are rotating.
Wheels that are rotating. Ground effect.
Sure.
All kinds of vortices coming out of the butt, like vortices everywhere, like
do those
all kinds of like really complex,
like
turbulent
like
flow,
smooth like phallic fuselage.
So like I'll give you this example. Planes, the first like, I think it's like the first like five per, like if you go down the fuselage, that first 5% of it is like laminar flow. The rest of it's turbulent,
sure,
or like transitioning. In cars, it's like 1% of it. Like the front of it's kind of laminar, and then it's all turbulent. Like all of it's separated and turbulent. And you're, like, manipulating how everything's separating and how everything's, like, falling over itself. And it's, like, well, it's really complicated.
I do appreciate that in F1, where there are a lot of allowances in what you can do, there are 10 F1 teams that hire the best people that mm-hmm. they can possibly get.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the same rule book applies, it is clear at the beginning of every year that one team is better at it than another.
Yeah.
Yes.
By a lot.
And it's also pretty amazing. Shout out Adrian Newey. I'm your biggest
fan.
That's
my boy.
Yeah. Come sign stuff.
Have you ever
please.
Read his book?
Yes, I love his book
so
much.
Good.
It's really inspiring, too. Like, it gives you a lot of ideas as an aerodynamicist.
You ever got a chance, you should. It's
How to Build a Race Car.
It's so good.
Super
read
awesome
that.
Book. But... So Adrian Newey, I think, is like a really prime example of somebody who's like, he treats it as an art form. Like he is he's constantly sketching stuff, constantly thinking about new ways to do stuff. I'm sure there's a lot of mathematical, quantitative stuff happening
still,
in the background.
He hand 100%. Draws almost everything still to this day.
Yeah. I'm just imagining him going, CAD servant, I have a drawing for you. Go draw this in CATIA. Go, away with you. I have another one. Come back in an hour. That's what I'm imagining his life is like. I'm sure it's not like that. I'm sure he's like really nice about it, but I'm just imagining him like handwriting this. He's like,
I guess he's a super nice guy in real life. I've a good buddy of mine actually worked in that engine department for a while.
Yeah. No, and it, again, and the other thing, it's not just him. I should say it's not just him. I think Red Bull as a whole has their whole process for how they simulate laps, how they understand what lap or what car parameters are the most important ones to optimize, and how to integrate that into the car setup. Like, they're the best at it.
Well, it's really easy to say that, given that they've been strong for the last 2 years. But right. There was, what, 7 years in a row where they were not?
They weren't, but the thing with the 7 years in the past, first of all, Mercedes is also up there with them, and I think they just made a wrong turn in their development path, which is very easy to do in aero. So, but I think, to me, like, Red Bull and Mercedes, like, they're the examples of, like, how you should run a team. Like, they have, I think they have all of their, like I said, like, it starts with, like, lap time sim, turning, like, integrating your aero numbers into that, like, all of that stuff. They have that figured out for sure.
If you want to talk about Formula One a little bit, though, think as well, like, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, how many races that Lewis had won and Max had lost on the basis of, like, certain strategy calls that are tiny little things in the race. And it's like, somehow, like, that strategy call was just, it was just the right one.
It again, that's like a tools thing. So they're not making that call intuitively.
Sure.
They are relying on a whole system that, like, is predicting the amount of time you're, the amount, like, basically race time. So there's a whole bunch of, like, very top secret confidential tools that these teams use that are, like, calculating a total race time, and they're just, like, plugging into this thing and, like, basically trying to figure out a strategy based on that. And they do make some, like, intuitive calls because sometimes you don't have enough time to, like, actually run the numbers, but, like, there's a lot that goes in, and that's the thing, like, starting at Pratt Miller, like, realizing how much is going on in the background is, like, it's a whole world. And I'm, and again, I've only been in the aero department. Like, the race team has their own, there's a lot going on there that I don't have time, you know, or skill to understand. So,
I got a, you're an aerodynamicist. So I feel as if you're going to weight that a little heavier. Adrian Newey has talked for years about retiring, and this may actually be his last year. Like, he's really, like, they keep pulling him back, but he's been wanting to go do, like, sailboats and all sorts of crap. How much is him leaving going to affect Red Bull? Do you believe that, like, he may be the key to hold that all together? Like, how much weight do you think that that he carries with the performance of that?
That's really hard to say. I'm not... Now I feel like I'm being interviewed as this, like, Formula One expert. I'm like...
No. I'm asking this because, and I'm sure, like...
I think
say this, but...
The systems in place at Red Bull and Mercedes, I think, it's not just one man.
No, by
like,
no
and,
means.
And I think...
But at some point, that spark has to start from somewhere to come up with a flexible nose cone.
I think there's people that are going to take up his mantle and they'll do just fine. I really do think a lot of it is process driven. And he's also been part of that process. Like, he's contributed to that optimization.
Do you think the process that maybe he put in place, that'll live on and they'll find somebody else to, like, find that spark from?
I think so. Christian Horner deserves a lot more credit, I think, than he gets.
Oh, for sure.
And the same thing with, like, Toto Wolff. Like, those guys are the guys that, like, are setting all the correct priorities and, like, integrating all these teams together. You look at Ferrari, and it's like, what is going on there? They've been, like, you know, like, it's ever since the early 2000s. Once things kind of got away a little bit from engines and, like, there was more, a lot more, like...
Ross Braun.
Yeah. But it's, like, it could be, like... They haven't had a good leadership in a long time, and it's very...
I'm reading that book
again,
right now, too,
I'm not,
and it's fantastic.
I'm not... I've never been in the room, but, like, from looking at it from the outside, the processes there are not optimized, you know? And I think at that level of motorsports, it takes...
So you'd be of the belief that the process is key?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I've kind of turned into co-host here, but I'm loving this.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Do you believe at a grassroots level that the process from a grassroots level, when you're trying to develop your own grassroots program for Time Attack or something like that, do you think there might be there's a lot to be gained there?
Yeah.
I kind of wish something like that existed, to where there was it almost like a basic structure to kind of help people get started. Everybody's going to have to find their own process. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're changing how we approach stuff all the time.
Well, then I'll ask you a specific question,
sure,
because I think it might relate to the conversation. You have indicated that there's not really much temptation for the rest of the weekend to go out and push harder because you're going to try and go to Mid-Ohio and run really well.
Yes.
So what would either of you do with tomorrow to learn something useful?
I feel like
I'm going out in the morning trying to go in after a record. But that data, we're already combing over data. I've got Graham combing over data to see if we can optimize this tune anymore, if there's anything we can do. We're trying to learn more about how to keep this engine cool. A lot changed with our setup. So tomorrow in the later sessions, I might play around with some small alignment stuff, but I'm only going to do basic section work once it gets hot, unless I have to step it up. Mm. I'm going to keep it really chill because the war for me is Mid-Ohio.
Sure. So what would you say, Ido?
I want to go out again in the morning session in better conditions. My goal every weekend is to come out of the weekend with one lap that I'm proud of putting on YouTube and like watching myself over and over and over again.
That's really fair too, and that's the other thing, like the nut behind the wheel. I've tried really hard this year to work on myself. I bought a really nice sim. I started just hammering that. I started going over data. I can go over data now because the car's more reliable.
Can I plug another podcast on here?
Yeah.
Lizard Brains podcast.
I listen to it religiously. Okay, good. I love those cats.
Big shout out to DJ. Me and him became really good friends back in 2016 or 2017. Mm-hmm. And he's helped me a lot with my mental game. I've talked on that podcast a couple times about like the mess that I used to be mentally, in terms of like when pressure's on and just collapsing and just like not having the right attitude of it. The mental game in what we do is, the mental game is like 80% of it. It's just like
getting
yourself in like the, it's both. It's how you're going to approach the lap, how you're approaching improving, how you're approaching driving. Like that's all a mental thing that you have to figure out. And, you know, I think what really separates pro drivers from a lot of amateur drivers is not necessarily like at limit skill. It's the process. Again, it's process. And I think it's the mental game of it that they're able to be consistent, and they know that like if they need to get that extra time, they know where to take it. Like, I recently put this together. Do you ever notice how like F1 qualifying?
F1 qualifying is the craziest time attack in the world.
But like
any event.
But like think about this, right? They're going faster every session, but they're not just like trying stuff. They're like doing this like, and I think what it is, the thing that I thought about is they're trying their best in practice. Like they figure out what a safe way to get around the track fast is, like what a good 99% lap is. That's their banker. And then in qualifying, when they're going for pole, they're not like changing everything up. They're changing like two or three corners, you know, or they're cranking every corner by this little bit, but they're not like guessing. Like you don't see. That's the thing. Like, you don't see them going off in Q3.
Not
like,
typically.
Right. Other than Leclerc, and I think that's a different thing. I think, like, Leclerc, like, really pushes a lot. But anyway, what I'm saying is most drivers, right, Q3, which is matters way more than what we're doing here, right, and is a lot more pointy end, they're not going off, like, every session. Every lap they put in is, like, most of them are clean. Like, these track limit stuff is, like, they're within inches, you know? So it's, like, if you really think about it, like, you need to approach driving in a very, like, as a process.
Well, you're, it's methodical.
Right. Like, you have to be consistent. You have to set this baseline level of consistency, and you're building on that. Like, that's how I'm trying to approach it. And that's what I mean. I think it's a really big mental game.
And I kind of razz on people who do the conventional time attack path in that I believe that some of the GLTC drivers that we have are so fast because the cars are insanely reliable for the most part. And on any given weekend, drivers get a lot of opportunity to get as much out of the car as possible. They can build up to pace and get a lot out of it. If your time attack program is built on, like, we're going to try to do 3 hot laps this weekend.
Yeah.
You really see that at the extreme pointy end of time attack where, I understand what you're saying.
Maybe the lap time was quick.
Yeah.
But are you proud of the lap? Yes or
no? Yeah. I don't know. I can flat out say
I've won events with laps I'm very not proud of.
Sure.
Okay, and like that's something that I wanted to change. Okay, I would watch stuff and hate it. Like I still look at my Road America lap from a few years ago.
22, right?
Yeah. That was the one where I pulled in and then you listened to my motor kill itself. It was, I watched that, and I can see so much time out there. And it just eats me alive.
Speaking of, did you guys watch that 213 video, Road America, the GT3 RS? The stock GT3 RS?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I could not believe it.
Again,
did you see that video of Michelle Abante in the Trans Am car losing a brake line coming into Canada Corner?
I didn't watch the video.
That was absolutely terrifying.
Oh, my God, I don't want to talk about this. As somebody driving a car that's way too fast and no additional safety, that stuff scares me.
Yeah, it terrifies me. That was the biggest reason I got a cage.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should do that.
Here's my thing with cages.
Oh, you still drive the car to the event.
Yeah.
That's hard
Okay. This is my whole thing with the cages and the extra safety thing with my car. I've talked about this with other people. So first of all, I drive it on the street. Once you put a cage in, it's not a street car anymore. An in-between step of, a roll bar doesn't protect you anymore in, the most likely fail cases.
Sure.
And it's why am I going to add that weight?
Especially when, in a modern car. It made sense in an old EF. Like,
right.
You roll that thing over, it could be real ugly.
For sure.
It's made of paper mache.
For sure. And also, it's a lot harder to roll a Corvette than even a lowered EF Civic because, the CG is so low, the car is so wide, it's... Anyway, I shouldn't keep talking about this, because then it just... I'm putting it into the universe, but, I don't know. I'm... That's the part I'm most uneasy about, is maybe I'm not respecting the safety enough. And I'm really torn about, what to do about that.
I think there's an argument to be made you're in a significantly more modern car.
Sure.
Okay. Like I'm in a 90s shitbox.
Sure. Sure.
It's a complete different story.
And that's what I end of the day what I hang my hat on in terms of safety. But yeah. Anyway, let's talk about something else because I don't like talking about this.
That's fair.
In terms of anyway, my approach with tomorrow, I should say, is again, I'm working on the process of improving as a driver, and executing laps consistently. Mm-hmm. You know, even right now where I'm leading the class and have a lap record, I went 4 off twice in 3 sessions, which is stupid. Don't do what I do. And it's I'm the first one especially, that was a process mistake where it's I didn't correctly weigh the consequences of pushing that certain corner. And I went 4 off because of it. So it's I need to improve as a driver. My general game plan tends to be in the beginning of sessions is I know what brake markers I can hit and drive the car fast. So I'm forcing myself that first lap. I don't care what my comfort level is just coming out. I'm hitting that marker. And that's how I approach it. I think that's why, I think I excel at the podium sprint. And I think that's why I'm doing well is because when conditions are right, that first lap, I hit it, and I do it well.
In my opinion, that is a crossover skill from autocross.
100%.
Yeah.
The fastest autocrossers also make the fastest time trialists and track drivers, because we're not afraid to push the car because we've done it in a much safer environment, and we know what the car's going to do.
Yeah.
Like, if anybody really wants to get good at time trials, autocross. Like, you just should. And you got to pick the right ones. Like, there's a lot of sites and a lot of clubs that run events that have courses that kind of suck and they're too low speed and they're like, it's not worth it. You got to pick the right events. And if you really want to, you know, get your ego bruised, like, go to a national event. And, like, the dedicated autocrossers, the really fast autocrossers, man, if they made their way to Time Attack, we're all in trouble. Like,
well,
all of us are in trouble.
In my opinion, it depends on the format
a
lot.
Yeah.
And knowing that I'm not anywhere near the driving level that either of you guys are, but for a time I drove like okay.
Mm-hmm.
I did autocross, which I thought helped me a lot in one lap, which helped me a lot at the beginning of a Time Attack weekend.
Yeah.
Where like I could go to a new place and I could get pretty comfortable really quickly. And so like at least in the events that I would run, I'd be like, you know, on the podium in like the first part of the weekend pretty quickly. But like throughout the weekend, I struggled to get much faster, and where other people were picking up speed throughout the entire weekend. And so like,
and that's a process thing. That's the thing that doesn't carry over from autocross. The thing that doesn't carry over from autocross is that lap to lap consistency. Because in autocross, at the highest echelons of it, echelons. English is my third language. Leave me alone. You have three runs.
Right.
And I think the very best, that first run is like a 95, 98%. Like the very best of the best, it's like a 97 or 98% run. And they get that last 2% on their next two runs.
Yep.
But on track, it's different. Like the pointy end, like the optimization is a lot more focused on track. There's a lot less just free time out there compared to autocross, because like in autocross, you're not the third run that people do. It's not like the best run ever that any, like most of the time, it's not like that's the best that course will ever be run. Like whatever. It's like a 95% run. And then if you did like 10 more runs at it, you'd get that last 5%. And I think the translation from like autocross into like time trials, yes, they'll be fast like the first couple sessions, but like the important habit or the important thing to learn, doing lap after lap consistently, and you're picking two or three points on track where you can gain time. And
sure.
You make sure every other turn you hit the same marks you did before.
Yeah. As good
and
as
I think
was
a lot
before.
Of people don't realize that. Like, I think a lot of people think that you're just driving harder. I'm just going to drive harder. Like, I'm just going to brake later. I'm just going to do that.
I catch myself falling into that still, where I'm just going to drive faster.
Yeah.
You know, and that it doesn't work.
Yeah. You have to, like, when you get to a certain point, it transitions from, like you're internally under, like, you can feel where the mistakes were. Once you get to a good enough point, you're like, okay, I got to look at data to like figure out where I'm making this mistake. You know, I think there's a few people like that in the Grid Life paddock, but I always wonder, like, as well as I'm doing, what would somebody like a Tom O'Gorman, like if I put him in the car, what's he gonna do?
Yeah.
And so like for me, I'm always like, I just got to keep improving, because like, I want to be that good. I don't want to be stagnant. You know, I don't want to feel like I'm this like big fish in a tiny pond. And then when I get, if you know, another, you know, ex pro or whatever driver comes to the class with a competitive car, and they just wipe the floor with me by like a second or something, like I don't want to be that guy. Like I don't want to be in that position.
Sure.
And that could happen easy.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Like, I set my fastest time today, my first session ever on this track, like two laps in. Like, clearly I'm not, like, clearly there's a lot more time out there.
Yeah.
and I've gone off track trying to find it, and that's not the right way to do it.
I actually kind of feel like Street Mod's a bit more insulated from that, because you kind of have to, you have to have a car that's fairly built for that class.
Ooh, I have opinions
on
this.
But you can just stroll, you can roll up into Street GT with a very mildly modified vehicle.
Currently, yeah.
And you can be dangerous right out of the gate.
I mean, Cody Hunt did that last year. Like, his Grand Sport had headers and a tune on it.
Yeah.
And it was a stock car otherwise.
Yep.
And you saw how he did. Like,
he was supposed to be here this weekend as well. He emailed me a couple of times.
He gave me his hotel room last night. Shout out Cody Hunt.
He's such a gentleman, too.
He's so cool. I love Cody Hunt. That's another one. Like, Cody Hunt's a really talented driver.
Actually,
my car is faster than his car, so I'm curious what he would do in my car.
Street GT's kind of been, like, it was a class that was maybe, like, slow to grow. But, like, Kobe's doing some, like, real stuff now.
Yeah, some real stuff.
And he was, like, the original record setter at Street GT. And then we've got Cody and Ito. Like, you guys are, like, it's a cool class.
I really love the concept of that class when you guys came up with it. And
I was
sad to see it.
Yeah, don't let it. I'm about to throw down here. Don't Club TR it, please.
What do you mean?
Club TR started out as it's a bolt-on class, full interior, like track rat.
I don't agree with that at all.
I don't remember that at all.
I disagree with you guys.
No, it's how people interpreted those rules. Somebody finally read the rules.
Hold on. All the stuff
TR,
that's in
Club TR, that is track rat. A track rat doesn't have interior.
The no interior thing was a Adam said it's okay, like, change. That wasn't written into the rules.
I don't think so. I think just nobody protested it.
It was,
we decided the minimum weight.
I don't want to say it was a bastardization, but if the class has a minimum weight and you are bound by that minimum weight, then what, I know the advantage you get by removing interior, but if you're not below the minimum weight, what's the argument to keep those things?
So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that there was a higher minimum weight for swapped cars than non-swapped cars. And I thought it was higher than what it is now.
It's 2550.
I thought it was higher than that at some
point. I don't believe
so.
If
you really, like, in my opinion, I don't know. I have a different vision for what that class was supposed to be. And this is kind of something I wanted to transition into. In my opinion, what attracts the most talent are classes with the least amount of prep. Because the people that don't want to build cars or that can't afford to build cars and they just want to show up and be competitive, that's
where
all
the talent
is. This
is what I was just talking about. That's
where
all the talent is. I'm insulated from that, and he's not.
It's an interesting point, right? Because it is two schools of thought in the same weekend, right? Mm-hmm. Sunday Cup and Club TR are closer to time trials. And that Street Mod is closer to Time Attack. They exist both within our series. They're just different rule sets for different...
I've never thought of separating time trials and time attack.
So conceptually, they're just different. And the reason I think they're different is you can't put a Street Mod car together that is minimal prep. It's not...
It doesn't
that's
exist.
That's, like, not right. What the class is.
Yeah.
It's a class for people who want to build things and do things. And that is completely different from Street GT, even, which and is I, like, no, just bring the car.
Yeah. And I don't disagree with the existence of classes like that. I think they're cool, and as somebody that enjoys seeing car variety, I think that's cool. But I do think there is a gap in GridLife's current classing system. There's not a low enough prep level class, in my opinion.
Sunday Cup
is full of, like, really dog shit slow cars. I'm sorry, all the Sunday Cup cars guys can come beat me up, but, like, I'm sorry, I don't want to drive a fit around Road America for sure.
It's not for everybody, and I get where you're at.
What I'm saying is there should be a...
You picked the...
Also, Sunday Club also has, like, you can take out interior there too, and, like, you're playing around with power to weight. It's like, no, I'm saying you make a class. Hear me out. You take a little bit of a page from an SCCA rulebook and be like, a class? Street GT is the closest thing. But what I'm saying is you need one that's like Street GT, but even less prep. Like,
so
all you allow...
Here's my argument to that.
Yeah.
Okay? Is the problem is instead of you building the perfect mousetrap, you will then just go purchase the perfect mousetrap.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't agree with that. And that's one of my...
Some
that's
people don't
want to
build cars.
I hate working
on cars, man.
See, the difference
I just
is
do
I love
I have
building
to.
That. And this is a builder class. Yeah. You're not in a builder class.
Right. I get that. I respect that. All I'm saying is, like, I think there is a little bit of a gatekeeping going on right now where, like, if I talk to some of, like, the serious SEC autocrossers that are really talented, they don't want to go to grid life because, like, they don't want to build a car. Like, I think you will legitimately attract more top talent with a class that's even lower, so, that's faster than Sunday Cup, but, like, lower prep.
So, your point is well taken.
And I don't mean to, like, criticize you on your own podcast. Moment, I'm just, like, though, putting it out there.
Given our events, it is hard to accommodate more people. Like, we can't...
Sure.
If we had more classes, we'd just have fewer cars in each class because we can't host any more cars.
And class proliferation is a problem in autocross right now, so I get it.
If you would argue that it would raise the level of talent, it would do so at the expense of pushing other people.
Does Street
out.
Mod and Track Mod need to be two separate classes?
In my opinion, no.
There you go. There's one. There you replace one of them with the class that I'm talking about. We got ourselves.
We pushed the Track Mod class that direction this year.
Okay.
What I'd really like to see is Dewey's car on some 285s. That's what I'd like to see.
What are you on now?
255s.
What?
Yeah.
That is so little tire.
So
it's some pleb tire over here. I'm on 315s buddy.
I'm going to be the guy arguing against that because I think Street Mod is this. The rule set as it sits is beautiful. And if you look at the parity in our class for how drastically different these cars are modified, it is nuts.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. If you had the same driver drive all those cars, do you think it would be that close?
No, but that's because it's a builder class.
Fair enough.
Okay, and that's the difference.
Sure.
And what happens when you get a 10 out of 10 car and a 9 out of 10 driver, end up with Jackie Ding.
Right.
Okay, and like a situation like me, I'm going to call myself a 7 out of 10 driver, and I still got a lot to do with this car, so I know where it's at. So an 8 out of 10 car, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it gets better, but that's where it puts me. But mm-hmm. I like that there is that disparity. And you don't – like a driver could make up for some modifications or the other way around.
Yeah.
Like one of the reasons a lot of us have massive respect for Jackie – back when he was doing the Ding Fling, but he would find time in cars that had no right being there. When he was running mm-hmm. against us in street, right. it was incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and that was super cool
Actually,
to watch.
It is. This is true. The origin of Club TR, in my mind, was Jackie's 38-0 in the S2000.
Yeah, when he put aero on it and just went Senate.
I was like, I like that. We should have more of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that was
well, it also sucked, too, for, like, let's be real. Grid Life has got a lot of Honda base to it, okay? Anytime I go to look at a modification on my vehicle, I think of how would they approach this if it was a Honda, and that's how we're going to find out if they're going to tell me yes or no. But
it was funny asking
but
for...
But either way, let's go... I wish you guys could see the look on his face.
It was funny asking for some clarification on some, like, small block stuff for my car.
Yeah.
And it was kind of... obvious that like Adam hasn't dealt with like any small block stuff.
Yeah, and it's okay.
It's fine.
I know
I'm not
how
trying
to approach
I'm not,
it. It's
sorry,
just...
sorry, Adam. I love you. I'm just saying, like it like there's definitely like a little bit of a knowledge gap there.
So there needed to be some place for a K-swapped Civic with no interior because there's a million of them. And Grid Life being
in
so
our,
Honda based,
in our universe,
there was
universe,
not
absolutely.
Anything in the ecosystem for that car.
Yeah.
And that's what I when I envision when you guys start talking about Club TR, I'm like, this is fantastic. That is for that car because Grid Life should have. You remember Mikey's old setup? Like,
yeah, dude.
Yeah, like that was
that
sick,
RSX
man.
Was a ripper,
and there was no place to put that thing.
We've been around a long time.
I'm fairly new to the whole. I only started running Grid Life events in 2021, I think, and I think I only did one that was in the 128. And earlier today, you were asking me like where you came from, and it's like I've been running Club TR in a 128i with no aero and like weighing 3,000 pounds. That's where I've been. I've been in the middle of the pack, like kind of like putzing around trying to keep up with 25, 50 cars with aero and like making more power than me. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I got sick of that, and I bought a car. I bought the car that I knew was going to be the fastest car in that class.
But again, you could. That's the difference between street GT, which I love the concept.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody can buy a very minorly prepped car and come out here and compete.
Yeah.
But that's the difference between building a mousetrap versus purchasing a mousetrap.
Sure.
And then a lot of the guys that are, you know, on the Time Attack side of this and came up reading Super Street, Sport Compact Car, and all this, we want to take a car that we love and be able to build it into something that is competitive. That's
sure.
why I went to Street Mod, because I was in Street, and at the time, a Subaru was just not competitive.
I have a hard time sympathizing with that, because I hate working on cars. I do it because I have to, because I can't afford it.
It's my livelihood, so it's different.
Yeah, I wish I could throw money at somebody to just, like, do the stuff for me, but, like, I do it out of necessity, and, like, I've learned a lot. That's great, I guess, but... if I could just purchase a car and be competitive in that, I would 100% do that. I enjoy, my enjoyment of the sport is not from building cars, it's from driving them.
Yeah.
And I totally respect that other people, it's the other way.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's just, kind of the other side to the this
humans are different, and
we're
it's fine.
We're trying to build a mousetrap.
Yep. I get that. And like, even Street GT right now, like, my car is on stock leaf springs with Coney Yellows and a front sway bar. Like, what I did over the off season is I put bolt-ons, because like, that's where, to me, I knew that's where like the easiest time was, is just make 80 more horsepower than stock, and okay, like, I'll figure out the rest of it.
What's the before and after on the dyno? Like,
I made,
you put
those,
an intake and like some headers.
So I did an intake, a throttle body, an intake manifold, and headers. Everything external
that's
to the engine.
Horsepower.
Yeah,
without
it's like 80 horsepower. And I make 530.
I
make 530 wheel horsepower, and I think those things stock dyno like 450 or something.
That's what a crazy world.
It's sufficient. The first time driving it in anger was at VIR in March this year, where it like snowed on the second day, and that's the first time I've been scared of driving a car. I'm not scared. Like, I don't think I've ever been scared driving a car on track. Like, it just doesn't... I'm confident in my ability to fix the car if something's wrong. As in, like, if the car gets sideways or gets loose or whatever, I'm confident in my ability to gather it back up. The first couple sessions in the vet were freaking terrifying. Like, the rate of acceleration was just, like, something that I'd never experienced before. And my bandwidth couldn't keep up for, like, the first couple sessions. By the time, like, the third and fourth session rolled around, started feeling a lot more comfortable with it.
If my ego could handle it, I would love to put him in boogie. But my ego cannot handle it.
Anytime. I'm open to it anytime.
Oh, man. That would be insane.
Yeah. It was, like, a huge bandwidth adjustment to, like, drive that car. And it's a tough car to drive. You can see on stream, like, there's so much, like, body movement. And you're constantly managing the rear, like, especially under braking and trail braking. First of all, the weight moves forward pretty slowly because it's so soft. And then once the weight's there, it doesn't come back to the rear as you're trailing that quickly. So it's like you're playing around with this like loose rear end on entry everywhere. And then on exit, you don't have enough tires. So you're just like managing throttle, and it's like hilarious.
So
I love it.
One of our GLTC drivers is Paul Curley.
Yeah.
I have known Paul since 2014, mm-hmm. when I moved to Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
He has had several Corvettes.
Mm-hmm.
One of them he used to time attack with has burned down. It was really sad. I rode in that car at Mid-Ohio, and I forget the exact corner numbers, but after the carousel, kind of where pit in is, you've mm-hmm. got a... kind of a right-hander and then a left-hander onto the start-finish, right?
Yeah.
I remember that car. He's a very fast driver.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that car, maybe third gear coming out of the carousel, putting power down, and, like, that change from, like, third to four. The car's tracking out, but it's not, like, driving out. It's, like, floating out.
Floating out, yeah.
And so you make that gear change from third to four, and
yeah.
it's like the car just, like, literally glides sideways because the rear is coming.
Yep.
And so the front's just kind of like going with it.
Yep.
Rather than like having it be a like a steady radius that
yeah, the or like you're steering towards it. Yeah, and one of the first things like I'm also an instructor for Good Life, which is awesome that we do that. One of the first basics of like at limit handling is like the one of the first things I tell them is like, do you feel like you steered the car to the outside or did the car steer itself there? And like one of the first indications that you're starting to drive at the limit is if from the apex to the exit, if the car is like neutral steering, like driving itself to the outside. And that happens like a lot more. You're managing it a lot more in a Corvette, like in my car. You know, it's a lot like it's more forgiving mid corner and like min speed. You can have a lower min speed because you're always going to run out of rear grip anyway. Driving that car fast, like if you're also maximizing min speed and also maximizing exit, you're just it's constant. Like,
well, it's interesting because like maybe you could say, and you'd probably be right that I was never fast enough to like be thinking about this in the Evo, but like on power past apex, I never ever felt like the rear was loose ever. I'm driving an Evo, so it's like an all-wheel drive thing.
Well,
but, like,
I'm gonna throw this out here too. Evo 10s are kind of magic in the way they move their diffs around.
Sure.
It can make a good driver look phenomenal, and it can make a shit driver look good.
But it's
that's me.
What I'm saying is, it's not an oversteer that's happening. There's a slip on all four wheels. You have your wheel perfectly straight, and because you've carried so much speed from the apex, the car is like sliding itself to the exit and also propelling forward.
Yeah.
Like it's not like a chasing the rear thing. It's a like you're carrying so much speed that the car is like kind of having that perfect amount of slip angle where all four wheels are at that slip angle.
You get boogie right. That feels so good. It's so good. All four spinning.
It's
you're
so good.
The
Corvette can
put next to no steering angle in.
Yeah. The Corvette can lie to you though, because like you could be thinking you're doing that, but you're just like putting more. You're just like yeah, power. but yeah, like in that the thing that I love about the Corvette is like I always feel like the limit of it is so high. And I have yet to feel like, yeah, I really got everything out of that car. Yeah, I'm like, that is all it's got. And like, I get, as I was saying earlier, like I've gone through a few cars in my short life. A lot of it is like, okay, like I feel like I'm, with the 128 in particular, I felt like me as a driver, like I was deserving more lap time than I was getting out of that car.
Oh, sure.
And I got, like, I was feeling like basically I got to the point where the car's optimized and I'm like finding these really small nuances on the track that I'm like getting this little bit of time out of. The Corvette feels like I'm always
seventh.
Like, the Corvette feels like I'm always leaving like a second or two on track. And really? Like, even good laps that I'm proud of, I'm like, I could, like, I bet if I was like really like dialed in, I could have gone like another half second or a second faster. Like, the potential of the car is so high. And I really do see it as a car that I'm probably going to grow with. And like maybe one day turn into like an aero like street mod car and like just go.
I'm not gonna build
it.
I'm gonna build it.
No, I heard that too. Actually,
yeah.
But you could say that if all you did was change the aerodynamic elements of your Corvette and you left the rest of the car.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of tuning, yeah, and that's one of the things that are underutilized in amateur racing is like tuning around the aero. There's a lot of stuff going on with, like, it's a little bit different. Like, street mod is still flat bottom splitter, like no diffuser, right?
No, we're allowed splitter diffusers.
Oh man, are you allowed flat bottoms?
No,
diffusers.
Splitter diffusers. We can do a rear diffuser from the center of the axle,
okay.
Rear axle.
Yeah. Back. So there's, I think at that level, there's a lot you can do with ride heights and rake and all that stuff.
Oh yeah.
That is gonna change your. The way, like, your aero balance, that's going to change your mid-corner balance, like, your, and that's, this
remember
is,
that conversation I had earlier with you?
Yeah.
Like, I'd love to pick your brain for about a couple
man.
Hours.
And that's one of the things, like, that's one of the things
so
I learned at Pratt.
So what's the timetable then? Let's say the year works out to a level that you're satisfied with your performance. Then what?
I'm currently enjoying the current prep level of the car. So I'm probably going to stick in Street GT for a couple more years, I think. It desperately needs coilovers, and I'm talking with a company about that right now, and I'm hoping that that works out. The next step in that car, I think, is coilovers. From there, like, man, I could put a different final drive. Like, final drives are allowed in Street GT, I think. I think you're allowed to mess with...
I don't think it's not allowed, therefore it's allowed.
I think that might be correct.
I think that's true.
Before I, like... I realize that Adam and I write the rule book, but I cannot remember every rule
off
the top
for
of
sure.
my head.
I'm thinking about that right now. I don't see why you couldn't do a final drive. Like, I've skimmed that rule book, and that would have been something that stuck out.
Yeah, so, like, right now...
any other class.
Right now, fourth gear goes to 160 in that car. Okay. So, like, I could be... like, I could shorten up the gearing, like, use more of my... like, the amount of torque I could increase, like, I could keep increasing torque. Like, there's a lot of development that can happen on that car, just in Street GT trim.
What gear are you in when you're at the end of the straight?
Probably fourth.
Oh, that's crazy.
And I'm doing...
track in third and fourth,
I'm doing 150 into turn one.
Yeah, I'm sniffing the top of fifth.
It's a completely different... Yeah.
So I don't follow you on YouTube, but it sounds like you post videos.
Yeah.
Do you data overlay your videos?
Since getting an AIM, I haven't, because it's... if you don't have a Smarty Cam, like, you have to, like, go into Race Render and, like, figure out how to do that. And
you're an intelligent person. You should do it.
No, I know.
Because,
I know how to do it.
That is outlet for me to, like, see where drivers are really quick.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie, he might do it for other reasons as well. But when he was posting lap videos all the time, I was like, Jackie, I know you have the data. Just put it in the video so I can see it.
Dude, like, the big... first of all...
some of that was he didn't want some of, like... I could post the data on things like that. I don't. Because it's turned into this, like, cloak and dagger situation.
I don't know what... I don't know.
Builder
what
classes
to gain.
Are different, man.
But I don't know what there is to gain there. Like, you'll just see another car that's it's accelerating faster than me. Damn it.
Driver is trying to go as fast as they can. So if you see a driver carrying, I don't know, 8 miles an hour into a corner different, you're already trying your best. If you see that speed,
the amount of data we got,
what are you going to do?
But if they're in a different car, it's irrelevant. Like,
the amount of data we got when we overlaid all of the street class cars at Road Atlanta going into 12. We overlaid all of our data once and looked at it. That was really, because it was like five of us.
Sure.
They're all really close to the top of that class for a while. That was really interesting. And that actually, like, that was one of the clues that I need to stop sucking as a driver. But it would be interesting to see more of that. But a lot of us are really secretive about things like that for, you know, whatever reason.
Sure.
I don't. I also need to figure out why my aim isn't actually connecting to my car's can. There's like some weird setting I think that's not working, and I have to figure that out. So I haven't gotten data since running an aim. Before that, I was running an app called Solo Storm, which was actually developed for autocross, and then they added like a time trial part of it. And I was running that with like a race capture, and it was great. And then the race capture broke, so I gave up. And like aim is just a much more reliable method of self lap timing.
Like fancy Harry's lap timer?
Extremely.
Okay.
Solo Storm is a $250 app, I think.
It's probably worth every penny.
It is. Because it's like, the nice thing about Solo Storm is like you can compare it on your phone and it's like completely fluid. Like you hook up a race capture or whatever to it. It's recording when you're out there. You come off track, you just look at your phone. You, like, drag it around, see where it is, see all the traces. It's super easy.
That's cool.
But, like, race capture itself isn't as reliable as aim. So it's, like, sometimes it won't record anything and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm sick of this.
You guys know my opinion on this already. Apex Pro.
Yeah. I had a feeling we were going there.
Stupid simple.
I don't have an iPhone. I don't believe in that.
Have they fixed the Android app yet?
They now have full-featured apps for both.
An Apex Pro. I don't use it because...
download the app right now.
Yeah, I'm good.
Actually, on this episode, at the beginning of this episode, there will likely be an ad for Apex Pro.
Sweet.
And it is about now that the app is native on both Android and iPhone.
I have it. I have the mount and everything in my car. I don't run it because I couldn't. So
let's fix this issue right now.
Yes, that's happening.
I would... be amazed if you don't find some value in it, because the time that it takes to go from the device to your phone where you can actually analyze data is seconds.
That'd be sick.
It's like, it is not the absolute most feature-rich tool on the planet. It is probably one of the fastest.
The thing, yeah. I think the gap for Apex is no vehicle integration.
Like OBD data?
Yeah.
They have that.
Okay, but it's like, that's like throttle and RPM, right? But like, if you want brake or steer, in my opinion, the most useful channels coming out of a car is actually brakes more than it is throttle. And that's the thing. I don't know. I think all of these different like data recording systems, like Garmin's, Apex, Aims, I think they're almost for different audiences, all of them. I think Garmin's for people that are kind of just starting out. They don't have like the best sense of like what mistakes are worth on track. Apex is like an intermediate step where it's like you have some idea, you want some help understanding where to go faster. Aim is for people who are like, I think they've gotten pretty good at understanding where the time is everywhere, and they need as much detail and as much reliability as they can, and they'll extract it themselves. That's kind of how I see it. That's kind of like the advice that I give.
It is my opinion that an Aim device is a fantastic piece of hardware. It's great.
Yeah.
I hate the software.
The software is really obnoxious.
It is capable.
I
think it's just because I'm not very good at moving around in it. Mm. And if I lived in it, I'd get better.
If you were a motorsport engineer and you lived there all the time,
it probably makes all the sense in the world.
In my job, I don't actually work with any of our like lap timing equipment or like lap data. But I don't know. I don't feel like Race Studio 3 is that hard. But it's inconvenient. Like, getting it off the Aim, putting it on the laptop, I get that that's like a thing that takes time and commitment that's harder to do compared to like Apex, where you just like pull it out on your phone and it's on your phone. Like, that's great.
It is true that the number of drivers that compete with us that use Aim systems, there are a whole bunch.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
I'm one of them.
It's also true the number of drivers that are willing or consistently do bring their laptop and open it up after a session, download everything, and look at it. The number of drivers that do that, I bet you, is less than a third.
I'm willing to believe that, let's say, 80% of the drivers that are using an Aim system are doing it for the lights, just so they know if they're up or down on lap time, at least within time.
Or just the big number display.
Yeah, that's a time. That's all they're using out of it, which honestly, like, Harry's can get you close enough for what you're using at that point. If all you're doing is using it as a basic lap time.
And most people that I talk to, they're like, no, I look at my data when I get home.
That's not useful. That's
what's
useful,
the point?
And actually, like, I wanted to look at data tonight, but I'd rather be here. Anyway, that wasn't meant to be like a seg into getting out of here. I was just like saying that, like, man, I want to be looking at my own data right now. But like, what I was going to say was, once Aim comes out with like a phone app that like integrates everything, I think that's like what I'm kind of waiting for.
Don't hold your breath on that, because it took a freaking decade to do an updated SmartyCam.
Oh my god! Don't get me started on SmartyCam prices.
Okay, now I'm gonna sit here and complain. I know this is like, I don't want this
price
big Aim
price
slam,
gouging.
But I've been so pissed about one particular piece of the Aim software that drives me up the wall. You cannot set a time attack mode. I want my all-time best time to show as my reference time.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
It is so in the morning, I'm going blind. I don't know if I'm up or down on time.
Yep.
That pisses me off to no end. And when I went and talked to the guys at Aim at PRI, they looked at me like I had four eyes. Like, why would you need that? Like, what do you mean, why would I need that?
Yeah.
And I explained, like, the format. Like, we're there for, like, 3 days.
They're
I want to know what I ran last year.
Yeah, and
I'm
they separate it into days, like, into tests and days. And it's like, that's not, like, my time from yesterday doesn't carry, like, my time from today won't carry over into tomorrow. That's cool, I guess. Like,
is such a stupid
thing. That is an oversight.
Thing.
That is an oversight.
And they, like I said, here's the even, this pisses me off even more.
This has just become the AIM criticizing podcast. Here we go.
Okay, and you can make it function like that in iRacing.
He had to turn down.
But you can't make it function like that in real life. Why? Why? Brick, I'm talking to you.
I like that Abe just like had to turn down.
I turned Dewey down.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm
the
so mad
yeah.
about that.
No,
I agree with that.
I don't know. Now that I know that Apex has like a phone app, maybe I'll give that a shot.
It's so good.
I don't know. I can't afford another. I already spent like
I just
$700
to see if I had mine. I always bring mine.
Yeah.
I think I left it on my desk at my house.
I need to try it out.
I gotta charge my Amazon.
Will Apex let me use like a different lap time reference? Or is it all predictive? I don't know enough about this. I'm now completely in the blind. So, is Apex the lights on the Apex Pro, are they purely based on like calculating a max G or max whatever
friction circle? Yeah. Okay. So the lights are the driver tool in car for sure. But
it's not doing a delta to a lap time.
No, it is not.
Okay.
But you have your phone in the car as well. And it can your phone will be the display of the times.
Sure.
And the phone will do a delta of a reference lap.
Okay.
I think both are really useful. Having the lights and like in situations recently, I always told myself I don't look at the lights enough because I'm always focused on what's ahead. And like when I found myself looking at them, I was like, oh yeah, I'm clearly going too slow here.
That would be a thing. I think that would be a weakness for me is like, If I'm gonna like hyper focus on those lights, and I don't think it'll make me I don't think it'll help my mental like game throughout the lap.
That said, like their app and their post session analysis is so much better.
Yeah,
it's so good.
I could see that. I could see that being the case.
All right, that's a plug for Apex Pro. Download Apex Pro today.
Well, I mean, if it's got an Android app, I'm in now because I use an adult phone.
That explains so much. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed a long one.
Slip Angle was created by Austin Cabot and Adam Jabe, co-hosted by Derek Yarbrough, and production by Abram Schmucker, who mixes all of our terrible audio. If you like the show, please rate us and review us on iTunes, and come and find us in the pits at a grid live to say hello.